And remember every time you sit down to make sure that the attitude is in the right place, that you have a sense of care and kindness for the present moment. The present moment is so precious, and it's so rare to have an opportunity like this. So care for it, be kind to it, and include yourself in that care and kindness, and then the attitude is just about right. And now let us try just a brief meditation on metta and kindness, just to take the meditation in a slightly different direction. So to start off, just imagine in your mind's eye the feelings of kindness, the feelings of generosity, all these beautiful spiritual states that we are trying to develop. Just bring up the idea what these things feel like, what these beautiful qualities actually mean to you. And then bring to mind the idea that there are so many beings in this world with these kind of qualities, often developed to very high levels. So imagine just another direction from here, all the people, all the invisible beings that have developed these qualities to a wonderfully, beautifully high level. And just focus on those beings and wish them well. May you be well, may you be happy. And then bring your mind around to the eastern direction there. Don't worry too much about exactly where that is. Just any of the four directions is fine there. And again, bring up this idea of all these marvelous beings out there with these wonderful spiritual qualities there. What a wonderful thing it is to share the world with such beings. Thank you, everyone, all those beings, for being these beautiful companions in this life. May you all be well. May you be happy. And then bring your mind around to the southern direction there. And again establish the perception of all those beings out there with all these marvelous qualities. These are beings that are truly worthy of your well-wishing. So allow it to come from your heart. May you be well. May you be happy. and bring your mind around to the western direction there. And if you wish, you can take, mix in a little bit of compassion into the mix. And remember that all these beings out there, they may have all these wonderful qualities, and yet there's always problems, always difficulties, including all the animals also existing out there. So once again, and you only need to repeat this phrase once or twice, and then just focus on the meaning, allowing it to lingering in your mind. May all those beings to the west, may you be well, may you be happy. And finally, allow your mind to spread out in all directions. And imagine a warm, beautiful light coming out of your heart, spreading out into the universe in all directions, touching beings wherever it goes. May all those beings out there, everywhere in the entire universe, may all find happiness in life, may you be free of suffering. And now, towards the very end, bring your attention back to your breath for a few moments. And now we're coming again very close to the end of the meditation. So look back on what's happened over the last half an hour or so. And if you feel more at ease, more better or brighter now than when you started out, ask yourself why that is the case. How does this process work? See if you can understand how things arise and pass away in the mind as a consequence of how you attend and how you perceive things. Okay, so good. Let's get started with today's questions. And number one, hi there, Ajahn. How long do you observe kindly pins and needles in the whole leg? Do they eventually go away, or should I just let go and wriggle it? Many thanks. I would not really recommend observing the pins and needles. I don't think that's a very like a meditation object as such. I would recommend you to stay with the breath, or stay with the metta, or stay with anything which is more like a traditional meditation object in the suttas. Stay with that. And if you find that the pins and the needles are very distracting, yeah, if they take you away from your peace, from your meditation object or whatever, that is usually the time to change the posture. If it is just something in the background which doesn't bother you too much, a small little problem or whatever, then it's no real issue. It's only when they become like obsessive and your mind goes to it and you're not able to let go of it. That's when it becomes really problematic. Yeah, so don't, I generally speaking, I don't really recommend you to stay with these kind of things very long. Just move around, change your posture a bit, sit on a chair, lean against the wall, whatever it takes to get out of these kind of problems. So. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I am a bit worried to see you and another monk wearing short sleeves. Yes, short sleeves is one way of putting it, that's right, yeah. It will catch cold in this extreme winter cool. Please wear the long sleeve, Ajahn. Thank you. Really. You are very kind. I really appreciate your kindness. But remember, I had a cold when I started that. Now I haven't got a cold anymore, yeah. So you see, short sleeve, pretty powerful. Yeah, you it works. And somebody actually gave me a very warm thing to wear, and I was wearing that a little bit today when I was walking around. It was very, very nice. That was given to me. It's like a winter, short sleeve winter thing. It covers the body, covers the main trunk. Yeah? That's where the most important thing to be warm. That is very, very sweet of you to say that, but I can assure you, if I get too cold, usually I look after myself. I'm not really, I try not to be entirely stupid. A little bit stupid, that's unavoidable, but. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, in the end of the retreat on Sunday, will we be going to have a picture together with you? I don't know. You tell me what to do at the end. I don't know what we... Usually I think... I have no idea. Speak to Bianca. She is really the boss. I tried just to be the slave, yeah? I give the talks. That's my job. I don't know anything about all the other stuff. So, see. But I'm... Yeah. So if anyone wants to be part of a picture, I'm sure we can arrange that. So see what happens. Perhaps on the stupa we'll look cool and we'll always be happy to remember this beautiful moment. Thank you. Okay, yeah, sure. Again, try speak to Bianca about it. She is really the retreat organizer. She is really the boss. And I'm sure that we can organize something like that. Just have to decide on the time, and then I'm happy to take part at least. Okay. Ajahn Brahmali, in addition to your monk training centers from last night, SBS Ipoh, Malaysia, started by Reverend Agachitta, it's headed by Reverend Kumara now, with Metta. Yes, that is true. There is a SBS center, the South Naraka Buddha Center in Ipoh, in Taiping is called, up there. And it's quite a nice place. I've been there myself. It's kind of located in the hillside. It was recently it was taken over by a Austrian monk, a European monk, who had trained in Sri Lanka and Burma. And his name is... what is his name again? Can't remember his name now. So they have recently kind of had a change of management there because Venerable Agachitta, he wanted to stay more by himself or something like that. But that might be a nice place to try out. Not sure exactly what they teach there, but that might indeed be a nice place. That's a good point. If anyone is interested in contact details, I can always help supply some contact details to these places. Anyway. Okay, good. Dear Ajahn, number one, what is the biggest challenge in your monastic life and how do you overcome it? Okay. Two, how to wake up from this virtual reality, samsara, when we still find pleasure in it. In theory, we know it is ever non-satisfying, yet we're still not awakened to it. What is my biggest challenge in my monastic life and how to overcome it? Well, it's just the same challenge as everyone else has, yeah? The defilements of the mind, it always comes back to that one way or another. And, you know, you sometimes meet people who are better at giving rise to those defilements than others. So you have to deal with people, deal with these things. It's basically the same thing as in any ordinary life. I don't think there's anything particularly different. The only thing is that as a monastic, you have more opportunities to stay by yourself, more opportunities to go back to the suttas, more opportunities to meditate. It's slightly different in that sense. And of course, your relationship with your monks is a bit different from relationship with a family. With a family, it's often kind of closer, it's a bit more attachment there. I know what it's like when I go back to visit my family. It's a different feeling. In a monastery, yes, your monks are around you, but monks always come and go. And you're kind of quite at ease with letting monks come and go. It doesn't matter all that much if they disappear. Or you don't. It's not that same kind of feeling as you have in a family. So it kind of, it's a little bit different. Basically, the challenges are really quite the same. Yeah, this is kind of no real difference there, I would say, between lay life and monastic life. How to wake up from this virtual reality when we still find pleasure in it? In theory, we know it is non-satisfying, yet we don't awaken to it. And that is exactly right. As long as you haven't seen anything deeper, you will find joy in ordinary pleasures of life. And that's okay. Yeah, don't think it's just because I said today that it is preferable to find the joys in the in the spiritual things. Just because it's preferable doesn't mean you should throw out all the other happinesses. If you do that, you're going to be very miserable. So please, enjoy. That's why I say to people, when you come here, enjoy your meals. Yeah, have a nice time. Go for little walks. Enjoy yourself. And this is so important to have happiness in life. And sometimes the Buddhist path becomes too strict. People throw out all the happiness, and then the kind of life becomes pretty meaningless after a while. So the purpose of some of these teachings that I were talking about today, they are more about how to gradually learn to look at things in a new way. Yeah, you contemplate these things, you consider them, and as you practice the path, as you do all the other factors, this starts to have an effect on you, and you start to look at things in a different way. I'm sure, I don't know about you, but to me, these suttas are so powerful. You know, it makes me think differently about things. I think about life. I don't really doubt the idea of rebirth very much. To me, it is pretty obvious that that is the way the world works, and because of that, I tend to have this kind of much more long-term perspective, and I'd like to kind of get that into other people as well. This is why right view is so important, because it does give you a different perspective. It really does change the way you think about things. You do look at the process more than the goals in life, all of these things. Yeah, it does have a really powerful impact. When people say that rebirth doesn't really matter in terms of, you know, how we think about things, I don't think it's true. It's not an absolute difference, but it can have a very powerful effect if you think about it in the right way. If you grasp, if you feel it emotionally that this actually is important, yeah, that is where it becomes very powerful. So just gradually, gradually, gradually enjoy your ordinary life. Also enjoy the spiritual life. And then make a gradual movement where you are substituting one kind of happiness for the other one. So you're less attached to the worldly life and you have a little bit more enjoyment from the spiritual life. That is the right way. And so you don't kind of think that the world doesn't become too dry and too terrible and too unbearable. That would be really, really bad. So it's okay. Don't worry too much about that. Just keep on reflecting and get that right view sorted out. That sutta we looked at today, the sutta about the sense pleasures and all the similes of that, it is almost like right view in a sense. I took it under right effort, and it can falls in well there as well. But also, it's like right view. It's a way of looking at the world, understanding where dukkha and sukha, happiness and suffering is, and all of these kind of things. This is sort of the nice thing about the suttas. They're not really easily classifiable. They are all a little bit about right view, yeah? But they also fall under the other path factors. So it's kind of a lot of it is about right view. Dear Ajahn, okay, I understand that kindness and compassion is a stepping stone to the Noble Eightfold Path. Am I correct? Kindness and compassion, a stepping stone, it is part of the Noble Eightfold Path, yeah? It is part of the very practice. It is integrated into the Noble Eightfold Path. So a stepping stone, it's a stepping stone in the sense that it is one of the stepping stones on the path towards awakening, if you like. Yeah? As a layperson, extending kindness and compassion to someone you don't know well could come with problems. It can lead to misunderstanding and suspicion by onlookers and perhaps over-expectation by the receiver and so on. So it is about how you do it. Yeah, you have to do it in a wise way. It is not just about extending kind of random kindness and compassion to people in the wrong way. You do it with care. You do it in a wise way. Yeah? And you do it in a way that you protect yourself, so you don't get into difficult situations that are difficult or whatever. Yeah, so you take... But you in so much of our life, kindness and compassion... is about people who we know a little bit at least. It is about family members. Very often the most important people to be kind to are our family members because they're so close to us. In the same way in a monastery, the most important people to be kind to and compassionate to are your fellow monastics. They are the first ones because if you can be kind to your fellow monastics, the people who are around you all the time, the people who, because you are around them all the time, sometimes they may irritate you a little bit, that's just life. People who are close to us are more difficult. Same thing in family life, because family members are there all the time, it is very difficult to not sometimes rub up against each other. So if you can be kind to your family members, boy, that is really hard practice to be able to do that. If you can do that, wow, what a wonderful thing that is. And being kind doesn't mean that you are just stupid. It doesn't mean that you never, kind of correct people or anything like that. But it's about how you do that, the kind of qualities you bring to that and all of these things. So indeed, be a little bit careful with strangers and don't be stupid about it. Be smart about how you do it so people don't misunderstand. Work colleagues, you know them a little bit. You can be kind to your work colleagues. By looking at them in a new way. Little things you can do for them. Would you like me to bring you a cup of tea? Okay, here you are, cup of tea. Yeah, something like that. Occasionally, not all the time. Not kind of because then it becomes like a compulsive thing. But when it feels right, when it's kind of you feel this is the right opportunity to do it. So be wise about these things. Sometimes you can be kind to strangers as well, but you have to feel it is the right time and place. Please let us know if the suttas explain how, to whom, how much to be kind and compassionate as a layperson. Are there any examples given by the Buddha in his teachings? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu for your excellent clarification, Ajahn. So basically, the Buddha doesn't really give any real examples like that. The idea is really to be, at the very least, to be kind. Remember, kindness and compassion, the primary thing about it is about your internal state of mind. Yeah, that's the most important thing here. That you're kind and compassionate coming from inside of you. That is the most important thing here. And you don't always have to express it. The expression of that kindness and compassion depends a little bit on time and place. So just feel it out. What feels right? What feels appropriate? There's always lots of opportunity. When I think about my life, I think, jeepers, I could probably be much more kind and compassionate than I am already. I could probably do even more. And sometimes you don't see the opportunities. So you think every time you open your mouth, you think, where am I coming from? Am I doing the right thing here? Yeah, there's so much opportunity in speaking with kindness, making your speech a gift to the people around you. It's a beautiful way of thinking about it. It's a gift. If it goes to other people's heart, then it is a gift. If people feel repelled by it, it's like, oh, okay, then it's kind of the opposite. So taking the opportunities when they arise is really what it is about. There are so many opportunities in our lives usually, if we look out for them. That is kind of the main thing here. Just trying to think if there are any kind of good examples in the suttas. Just kind of work on it. Think about it. Look at the opportunities. I'm sure you can. It's good that you. Sometimes we can all give too much information. And one of the nice things about the suttas is that when the Buddha teaches the Dhamma, he often teaches like a bare bones kind of framework. He doesn't actually give all the meat on the bones. He doesn't give the whole story. Often it's like a very kind of bare thing. And sometimes we have to fill in the details ourselves. And I think part of that, an important reason for that, is because the bare kind of ideas of the Eightfold Path and all of this, they are the same for everyone. But the details can often differ, depend on your personality, etc. So if he gives too much information, then information will not be universal anymore. So he gives just enough information so that it is universal, and it is for up to us to apply it properly in our own lives. So think about these questions, yeah, carefully in your own life, and then I'm sure you should be able to resolve that by yourself. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, if the wisdom of the person in this life can follow to the next life, how about the skill of the person, like a good cook or a famous baker, can continue to the next life? Yes, probably. Yeah, if you are a good cook, and then in the next life that kind of will reawaken. Yeah, and you will kind of continue being a cook in the next life as well. Quite possibly, yeah, because it is a habit, and we carry these ideas in our mind. And if you like good food, yeah, well, everybody likes good food, but some more than others. In that next life, you will still be doing the same thing, quite likely. So I think that is indeed correct. And if the person is practicing the five sila and good Buddhist and wishes to be born in a certain country, will these wishes come true? If you are practicing the five sila, the five precepts, and you are a good Buddhist, very likely you will continue to do that in a future life. Yeah, very likely. But it also depends on the conditions in that life. So if you are, you know, if you get reborn in the wrong family or whatever, then you may lose those things. So the more established these things are in this life, the more powerful you are in your precepts, the more kind you are, the more good-hearted you are, the more chances it is that you will continue in your future life. The more deeply you understand the suttas, the more deeply you have right view, the more chances there is that right view will continue in your future life, because it is deeply embedded in your mind. It's not something which is easy to dislodge. So take this life as far as you possibly can in this life, these teachings. Your practice of meditation, your practice of virtue, your understanding of the Dhamma. Yeah, take it as far as you possibly can. And then it's deep inside of you. You come into the next life, you will almost like be born as a Buddhist in a sense. Yeah, come out with a Buddhist flag on your forehead or something like that. This is kind of the things that happen. Be born in a certain country. I don't know if it is necessary to be born in a certain country. You know, what country would you like to be born in? Like Sri Lanka, perhaps, or Thailand, or something like that, or Burma. Sometimes it may not be the best thing. You never know. I was born in Norway. That turned out pretty good, you know. Well, so far, so good. It's not so much about where you are born, I think. It can be helpful to be born in a Buddhist country, because there's more chances you will come into connection with the Dhamma. But sometimes you just become a Buddhist in name. Yeah, I'm born a Buddhist, so I'm a Buddhist. And then you don't think about it, and you kind of go about your daily life, and you don't really know much about Buddhism. It's like me. I was supposed to be baptized. Yeah, and see where I ended up. It's pretty. That was a bit of a failure, wasn't it, that baptism, isn't it? But my family wasn't religious, so baptism was just part of the tradition. That's what you do with little children. Okay, baptize them, whatever. Yeah, and then but of course, my family wasn't religious. I never really had a Christian upbringing. I never ever considered myself to be Christian. I was always like agnostic, and I was nothing really. That's how I always felt my entire life. And same with my family. I never knew anyone who was Christian. Where I come from, nobody was Christian. Nobody was really religious. Yeah, they had an even worse religion, the religion of materialism. That was even worse. Yeah. That was really bad religion. Yeah. So, and then, I wouldn't try to, wish to be born in a certain country. I'm not sure if that is always right. It's very hard to know what is the best thing to do. But usually the karma will kind of direct you in the right way, because if you are good Buddhist in this life, it means that you have a bit of attachment to Buddhism, so you're very likely to be reborn in a family that at the very least is sympathetic to Buddhist ideas. Yeah, quite likely. Yeah. If the person can speak more than two languages, can you do so in your next life? Okay, well, there's a big mix of questions here. Okay, can you speak one or two languages also in your next life? Thank you so much. I think quite likely, if you have a kind of capacity and you enjoy languages, it's quite likely that too will carry on from one life to the next one. You won't be able to speak those exact languages, but your general attitude towards languages will be the same. Yeah, you will enjoy that flexibility of speaking many languages or whatever. And you have that propensity, perhaps, of enjoying languages and these kind of things. So I think, again, it's this, your your intention or your inclination of mind will tend to be similar as you go from one life to the next one. So for that reason. But, you know, and there are some interesting cases. They call it xenoglossy or something like that. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word. And xenoglossy is like this idea that where you speak a foreign language. Yeah, like, for example, you have people who they go through a trance or something, or you hypnotize them, yeah, and then suddenly they start speaking a completely different language. This is kind of fairly well known in circles that investigate paranormal phenomena and these things. You know, you are kind of born in Australia, and then one day you kind of, you know, you go to the someone who hypnotizes you, and you start speaking Sinhala, yeah. And people say, what? Where do you get that from? And don't know, yeah? And of course, the answer might be in those cases that you were Sinhalese in a past life. So the Sinhala is still there. It's waiting to come out. And you get to go into a deep state of samadhi or deep state of hypnosis. And then it starts coming out again. So sometimes it is possible, I think, to bring languages like that over from a past life into the next life. But it's not very common, yeah? So I kind of wouldn't kind of count on that too much. Okay, dear Ajahn, thank you for having me here. It is very nice to have you here. Not sure who you are, but I'm very nice to have you here, regardless of who you are in this hall. It's wonderful. It's always wonderful when so many good people come together. So it's a very, very positive thing here. So my question is related to the sense of non-self. One, how do I contemplate non-self concept to my daily life and actually practice it? One of the ways of contemplating non-self in daily life is to remind you that things tend to be out of control, out of your ability to control. This is actually a very powerful way of reflecting on non-self. Why? Because one of the things that we take to be ourselves is the doer, the controller, the one who tries to organize the world in the right way. Yeah, this is a very large part of non-self. So remind yourself that the world very often is out of control. Yeah, this is the whole idea of impermanence. So things are always changing. Things are not stable. Things are not controllable. And when you remember that, what happens is that you are not so surprised or so distraught when things go wrong in life. People go wrong. People go wrong. Everything goes wrong in life. You can deal with it much better because you know that this is out of your control, that things go wrong. So remember, things go wrong. Things are out of control. When things don't go right, when things go wrong, it actually hasn't really gone wrong at all. It's just the nature of things that things have to go that way. So this is actually a very simple way of thinking about non-self. And it means that you tend to go more with the flow of things. Yeah, you become more accepting of problems and things. You can still try to do something about problems when they arise. But you also remember that maybe you haven't got the power to change things. And if you haven't got the power, well, then again, you really have to either extricate yourself from that position or just go with the flow again. So non-control is a great way of thinking about non-self in daily life. So you just kind of go with the flow of things. Number two, the same goes to impermanence. How do I contemplate impermanence in the daily work life? Many thanks. There's a number of ways you can do that. One of the ways to contemplate impermanence is to remember every day that death is always a possibility. People do death contemplation, and it can be very useful. Yeah, because if you know that you may die today, how are you going to treat people on your deathbed? If you're about to die, how are you going to treat people around you? Is the last thing you're going to do is say something? You're not going to say bad things to people if you're just about to die. You're going to be friendly. If this is the last time you're going to see someone, you tend to act differently because you know you don't want to die with that regret in your heart or having said the wrong thing. So just remembering that you could die today means that you start basically to become kinder, you become more caring. All the good qualities often come out of a simple contemplation like that. Death contemplation is a very powerful contemplation of impermanence. The other thing, as I just said before, is that everything in the world is impermanent. Yeah, all the world around us, very often when things go wrong in the world, we think, oh no, what's happening with the environment, what's happening with politics, what's happening with everything? Yeah, things are unstable. When I grew up, the world seemed so stable. Now it seems to be all over the place. What's happening? And of course, it's just the nature of the world to go in various ways. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything about it, but it also means that we understand the limits of our ability to change things, so we don't get too concerned about these things. So in a sense, impermanence is just this ability to go with the flow, to allow changes to happen, not to hold on to things too hard, including our own views and opinions, but going with the flow. Some degree of holding on is going to happen, but the more you contemplate impermanence, the more you're able to let go and allow things to be the way they are. It's a tricky balance, because sometimes people say that this makes Buddhists very passive. Yeah, we just sit there and say, yeah, everything is, you know, this is the way the world has to be, whatever, close my eyes and wash my breath, you know. And that is, and sometimes it seems like, shouldn't we also do something to improve the world? And yes, we should, but we try to kind of do it in the right way. We find in the right balance. When we can be effective, we do things. When it's hard to be effective and we just get frustrated, we pull back a little bit. We find that balance there somewhere. And when we try to do good things in the world, we try to do it out of kindness, out of support, out of compassion, out of good, positive motivations instead of coming from anger. Too many people who consider themselves to be activists in the world, they gain the energy from anger, and I think that is not a very Buddhist way of doing things. Because when you come from anger, you are distorted. You have certain vested interests, certain people you like, certain you don't like, and you end up creating a mess out of it if you come from too much anger. So that is not really the appropriate way. And also the energy you get from kindness, from compassion, from these things is a much more sustainable energy than the anger energy. Anyway, that's getting a bit on the side, so let's go to the next one. Dear Ajahn, my question is on the five types of people considered in the sutta on removing resentment. I appreciate some clarification on the typical characteristic of the person with pure and impure bodily behavior, pure and impure verbal behavior. Thank you so much for help to understand the suttas. Again, the point, I think, of those suttas, of that sutta, is not to really distinguish on the one hand with pure bodily behavior and pure verbal behavior. I think the purpose simply is to say people are complicated. People have good qualities and they have bad qualities. That is the purpose of that. It's not to say that you should focus either on the bodily behavior or on the verbal behavior. Simply it means focus on the good qualities, don't focus on the bad qualities. That I understand to be the meaning of that. So it is a broader application than perhaps what comes out from that sutta. So, again, if you want, I can also talk about bodily behavior. So bodily behavior is just what we were talking about yesterday. In the suttas, the bodily behavior is always classified as threefold. Whether we kill or abstain from killing living beings, one is good, one is bad. Whether we steal or whether we are generous, or whether we steal or abstain from stealing. Sexual misconduct or non-sexual misconduct. Those are the three ways of behaving rightly or wrongly. That is basically what it means. But you can expand that. Because that list does not include violence, for example, but of course, bodily violence, torturing someone or hitting someone or whatever, of course, that is part of that as well. So sometimes we should not allow us to be completely limited by these categories. We should actually reflect for ourselves when we are overstepping the bounds of morality. Whenever you are, your action, ultimately, whenever your actions are driven by ill will, by greed, by delusion, then you know there is a problem there. That is the ultimate decider for what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. And the same thing with the verbal behavior. It is nicely divided into lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter, the four ways of bad behavior, bad verbal behavior. But of course, that too can be expanded further if you like. And then you have the opposites for the good verbal behavior. Okay, so I hope that helps. If not, please come back again later on. Okay, D.
Dear Madam, thank you for your profound teachings. My question related to life in practice. I plan to pursue PhD study and to make some course advancement. I am aware now that I am on the edge of PhD charcoal pit. Okay, very good. And soon to be roasted chicken or some or charred something. Ajahn, I am at the crossroads to be strategic and invest more in Dhamma teaching and practice, or same old another bone with smeared blood. Please advise. I have my mother to support, so can't quit my job yet. One of the beautiful things about the Buddha's teachings, one of the things that he does say in the suttas, is how we should make decisions in life. Yeah. So how should you decide whether you want to pursue your PhD study or you should not do that? So the question is one of these questions of that people come across all the time. How do we make decisions in life? And if you really are serious about your Buddhist practice, if that is what really matters to you, if you understand the importance of purifying your heart and mind and to be more wise and to understand things according to reality, to attain samadhi and all these kind of things, if that is really what matters to you, if that is what your life really is about, then you should ask yourself, what can I do now to make that the greatest to give that the most chance to develop now and in the future? So what choice will give you the best chance to develop your kindness, to develop your mindfulness, to reduce your defilement and anger? So is that going to be the PhD study, or is it going to be something else? Which one of those will give you the best opportunity to do that? I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong, because it's impossible to say that. You have to make that choice yourself. Which one will align most with the Dhamma? Yeah, that's the question. If you are about to choose a job, for example, which job will give you the most chances to practice the Dhamma in a good way? Which job is just too much stress and you know that you're going to be angry and negative because the stress is just too great? And which job kind of has less stress and allows you to be a more wholesome person? A nice job which gives you time to do a meditation retreat once a year at least, that sort of thing. What partner in life should we choose? Should we choose someone just for their external appearance or their status or whatever? Or should we choose someone who is compatible, who we can go on retreats with, or who kind of have a similar understanding to us? So all choices in life can come back to that. What is it that will enable me to grow in wholesome qualities and decline in unwholesome qualities? This is the question you should ask yourself here. So if you are still looking after your mother, and you have to do that maybe until she passes away, perhaps. I'm not sure exactly what you are saying here, but not maybe what you are talking about. So then you have to kind of be prepared to do that for a few years, until eventually she passes away. And then you have the freedom. So how can you lead up to that point with living your life in the best possible way? These are the kind of questions you should ask yourself. And then you have a system, a method for making decisions for yourself, rather than being given an answer on the plate, which may not really be applicable anyway. So these are basic principles for decision making. And these are kind of things I talk about on every retreat. So the first one is to ask yourself, when I choose now, what will lead to my long-term benefit in terms of spiritual qualities? This is the number one way of making decisions, how will mindfulness, kindness and all of these things increase and the bad qualities decline? Second way to make a choice is to make sure you make a choice when your mind is free of defilements, when you feel at ease, when you feel a degree of clarity in your mind. You're not overpowered by all of these things that have kind of vested interest in them, which drive you in certain directions. This is the other thing. Don't make choices when you're angry. Don't make choices when you have strong desires. Make choices when your mind is at ease, relaxed, clear. You know what is going on. Those are the two main ways. And the third way, this is not my, this is Ajahn Brahm's way. Ajahn Brahm always has some very tricky ways. So Ajahn Brahm says, you take a coin, Heads, I do A. Tails, I do B. And you flip the coin. Lands, hook in your hand. Okay, so now, very exciting, yeah? If it's heads, I have to do A. If it's tails, I have to do B. Or the other way around, whatever it was, I can't remember it. So very exciting, because this is going to kind of decide your future, yeah? This is a big decision. You're making the choice by tossing a coin. You look, heads. You think, oh no, I don't want to do that. Okay, then you do tails. Yeah? Isn't that interesting? It's like a psychology for actually finding out how you feel about something. That's kind of the idea there. You don't actually follow the heads or tails. You see your reaction when you see what the coin says, and then you do what is appropriate. It's kind of a smart trick. It doesn't always work, of course, because sometimes you kind of you know the trick already. But sometimes it works, and it's a kind of little thing there to help you decide. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if a stream winder is on the path to one's returner, and for some reason he decides to commit suicide, will he get Sakadagami Pala and become a one's returner a few moments just before he passed away? Probably, yes. Yeah, so if you are a stream winder, you decide to commit suicide, and you are on the path to becoming a once returner, then usually the way I understand being on the path means that you have to become a once returner before you die. Yeah. So if you commit suicide, then often what happens is that at the moment of death is always a very powerful moment for insight. So very likely something will happen when you die. Yeah. And then boom, bang, the path comes, poof, and you are a once returner as a consequence. So I would say yes is the answer to that. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, your lightheartedness and yet sincere effort to help us come out of our suffering has touched my heart deeply. My ignorance is starting to peel off. Okay, that's wonderful. Gradually, as I begin to understand how to practice the right way, the Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha, and a certain Devata of stunning beauty must be also proud of you. Thank you so very much. Okay, that's great. It's good that you get a little bit of inspiration in the Dhamma. Remember one of the things about inspiration. Remember, sometimes you get on a little bit of a high. Things are going really well. But remember, those highs don't always last. And this is one of the things to remember about the Dhamma, is that it goes a little bit up and down. And you have to kind of have that perseverance and commitment that takes you through the difficult patches as well. Sometimes you see things that really are really disappointing on the Buddhist path, and it kind of drives you away for a while. And then you kind of come back, you reapply yourself, because you understand there's something broader going on. So be aware of that, yeah? And then this long-term ability to take the challenges as they come, to deal with the problems as they arise, to re-establish the inspiration, but in a new way. In the beginning, the inspiration is sometimes a bit naive, yeah? We don't really know what we're dealing with. And after a while, you develop a deeper inspiration, a deeper understanding of the Dhamma that carries you through difficulties and carries you through times that are not so obviously easy or whatever. Yeah, and this way, you kind of have a long-term practice. And one of the most important things for doing that is to come back to the word of the Buddha. One of the things that I love about the word of the Buddha is that you can hear so many Dhamma talks in the world from various teachers, but there's something about the word of the Buddha that is kind of more profound, more solid, deeper. It touches you in a deeper way. And that I find is very, very useful. So you get the word of the Buddha, and then you hear other Dhamma talks to kind of keep you going. And together, these various approaches to the Dhamma together give you a very powerful, kind of keeps you going on the path. And as you go, you start to feel it working in your own life, and that it becomes even more powerful as a consequence at that point. So good, I'm glad that you are saying that, so please just keep going, and then things will be going really well there. Ooh, okay. I thought that might be the question. I was having trouble reading it. This is Sinhala characters. You see those Sinhala characters? Yeah? Sinhala characters. Is that right? Anna? Yeah? I think it is similar characters. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, I'll get to the question instead. Looks very nice, doesn't it? I really like these characters. They're kind of very... Okay, anyway. Dear Ajahn, in regard to eating at the proper time and the 8th precept, is it allowable to set the time at 1 p.m. instead of midday, 12? Oh, that is very bad, you know. Because in the time of the Buddha, people don't have a clock and thus cannot tell time accurately here. Usually for the monastics, the idea for monastics is that you have to eat before midday. So it actually refers to solar noon. So when the sun reaches the zenith, bang, that's the time, the zenith time. So what that means is that sometimes the time, occasionally it's before 12, but usually it is sometime after 12, like 12:15 or something like that. And if you have summertime, you know, you have the daylight saving time, that sort of thing. Sometimes it can be even later. So that is what we use as monastics. On a retreat like this, it doesn't matter. We can pick any arbitrary time, really, which is approximately right. It can be 12. If we set it at 1, I don't think there's a big issue, if that is the consensus that we want to do that. But it's kind of handy, you know, if you know it is midday, 12 is the time, it kind of makes it easier, because I think everybody can agree on that. Once you start to shifting it, you may come into disagreement and you may have different ideas about things. But in principle, I don't really mind if we, you know, change the time a little bit. It's only a very small thing. I don't think it's really, it makes much difference as far as the practice is concerned. And I have been on retreats before when that has been done. Yeah, we have decided it was almost impossible to eat at the right time because the food wasn't served at that time or something like that. Okay, so we decided we have instead the cutoff time at 1 o'clock. So it's like, 7.8 precepts or something like that, It's kind of not full 8. And that's okay. We can decide exactly what we want to do. It's up to us how many precepts we want to follow, so it doesn't really matter. So it's more important to be flexible and rather than to be too stringent with these kind of things. That's kind of my general idea. But as a monk, I always try to follow that rule quite strictly because and the reason is simply that if you have a clear cut-off point, and you follow that one, then it's very clear what you have to do. Once you start stretching it, it becomes very unclear where the cut-off point is. So that's why I try to follow that quite strictly at all times as a monastic. But for on a retreat like this, it's a very different story here. Okay, the mind is not located in the body. Where does the mind dwell? Okay. Questions. That's a question already. What do you mean, questions? Then you have more questions. Okay. So, is the mind dwell near the body, or the mind can be in another dimension, or very far in outer space? Usually, the mind is kind of roughly the same. It occupies roughly the same space as the body. Yeah? So that's why you can feel things when you touch here and all this kind of thing. The mind and the body are roughly occupy the same space. So if I, for example, were to extract your mind from your body, you would look roughly the same. This is from the sutta. I tell you, everything is in the sutta. So you, in the sutta, it says that if it is like if you take a reed has a sheath, and you pull the other reed out of that sheath, the reed that comes out looks roughly the same. Or a snake comes out of its old skin, it looks roughly the same afterwards. If you pull your mental body out of your physical body, there you are, it looks roughly the same afterwards. It's the same kind of body, basically. So roughly, mind and body are occupy roughly the same space, is basically the one way of looking at it. But of course, one of the things that you can do, according to Buddhist suttas, is you can extract your mind from your body. And if you do extract your mind from the body, then your mind is capable of going anywhere almost. This is how you can have things like, they call it astral traveling, this sort of stuff. You read in popular kind of New Age books about astral traveling. You kind of make some kind of, at night, for example, lucid dreaming, and then you kind of go out of your body, all this kind of stuff. And these things can be done also according to the Buddhist suttas. So you can actually extract your mind from the body in that way. It's possible. And this, of course, is exactly what happens during near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences people have. That's exactly what is going on. Mind and body kind of separating in this way. Are feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness separate entities but grouped very closely together, or they are separate and they're scattered everywhere? Please explain in detail. Okay, many thanks. Mental qualities, the five khandhas, are usually kind of one group of phenomena, and that phenomenon is called experience. Yeah, right now you experience all five khandhas, all these five aspects of personality come together in this moment of experience. So they come together. But the point is that as you meditate, for example, some of those khandhas can fall away because you are simplifying your experience. That's what I meant before about reducing the khandhas. The khandhas are getting less. You are simplifying your experience. So, for example, the rupa khandha can fall away. The body disappears. Yeah, your five senses disappear. The rupa khandha, pluk, gone. And what you have left are the four mental khandhas. The sankhara, the volitional formation, the intentional activities, the will, the choice, yeah? I don't like volitional formations. It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know if it makes sense to you, but to me it's kind of a weird word. Better to use something we can understand. Choice, yeah? Will, maybe? Intentional activities. These words are more meaningful to me. That too can fall away, yeah? Because when you become more and more peaceful, there's less and less activity going on until the mind is completely unified and still. All will has disappeared. Then there is the three remaining khandha, consciousness, feeling, and perception. And these three khandhas always have to be present in all conscious experience. But they can be refined, they can become less of them. You can have less feeling, or you can let go of certain feelings and only have some feelings. You can let go of certain perceptions and only have very refined perceptions left. So some degree of those khandhas are always present. There's always some feeling, there's always some perception, and always some consciousness. Except if you go to a state called Sanya Vedayita Nirodha, which means the cessation of all feeling and all perception. And that's also possible according to Buddhism. And this is the highest happiness. Isn't that kind of radical? The highest happiness is when all feeling ceases. Yeah? When everything is gone, when everything has disappeared, that is the highest kind of happiness. This is straight from the suttas. So how is that possible? If you don't feel anything, how can it be called happiness? And that is precisely the point. The point is that if you compare the experience of feeling, you compare that to the experience of not feeling, not feeling is superior. If you compare the experience, it's actually not even an experience. If you compare non-experience to experience, non-experience is better than experience. It's kind of weird, isn't it? But that is basically how, you know, the Buddha, in the deepest aspect of his teachings, that is what he's saying. Dear Ajahn, what causes inner speech during meditation? How can we reduce its arising with metta? What causes inner speech? It is habits from the past, yeah? It is kind of, we've been talking a lot in our lives, so we kind of, the speech kind of comes back to us. It often is driven by a bit of restlessness. You're not perfectly content, so the mind wants to talk to itself. The mind wants to kind of, you know, be interested in other things. The more happy you are in the present moment, the more you enjoy what you're doing now, the less inner speech you're going to have. Because the inner speech is like a distraction. If you are happy, you don't want to be distracted anymore. So the critical thing always, and this is why so much effort is placed on the idea of enjoying the meditation. This is why I say enjoy it. Because when you enjoy it, there's much more chance your mind will be peaceful as a consequence. If you have a lot of pain and problems in the body, then more inner speech is likely to arise. Because you start thinking, how can I get rid of this? This is really painful. Or you will distract yourself by thinking about, you know, all the nice meals you're going to have in the evening when you come back home after this retreat. Yeah. And sometimes people do think precisely like that. You know, if you don't enjoy your meditation, you will think about, you know, eating and whatever other pleasure that you kind of get into. So inner speech, largely driven by restlessness, driven by considering the importance of those things that you're thinking about. Yeah, you think that they are important, so your mind goes there. Yeah, it matters. It's so important. I've got to resolve this problem. Yeah, meditation, yeah, whatever, later on. But now, I've got to resolve this problem. So it's a matter of priorities. You're prioritizing certain things over the meditation practice. So that also gives you the clue of how to reduce its arising. Change your priorities. Know what is important in your life. Now you are on retreat. You get this opportunity very rarely. Use it well. Yeah, don't waste it by thinking about things. Once you are finished with the retreat, you can go back to think about those things again afterwards. Remember your priorities. What is important in your life? What really matters? All of these worldly things, when you come to the end of your life, you're going to have to go all that anyway. It means nothing. Yeah. What is so weird is that it seems like all of these projects we have, they are so important. Yeah, we're always going towards some goal or something. And then you die, usually, in the middle of a project. You never get them finished anyway, those projects. They're always kind of outstanding. So finish it now instead. Now is the time to finish these projects, because there is no end to them otherwise. So you think like that, and then you draw yourself back to the present moment, and you don't allow the inner speech to gain so much power. But in the end, really, the thing which causes the inner speech to calm down the most is that you are simply enjoying what you're doing. You see the value and the happiness in meditation practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I find that if I'm upset about someone and a friend comes along and counteracts everything I say with something positive, incredibly annoying. I feel that I am not heard. My feeling is wrong. I feel like being told off, and I shouldn't feel that way. I should repress myself. I feel it was a mistake to share the truth experience with such a person, and I don't want to reveal myself again. So I feel very alone in my own difficulties. Another scenario, the conversation becomes a debate between the praise against the blame. That's also very frustrating. I don't think I really want to be right that much. I just want some comfort. Sometimes I think people are afraid to hear anything negative and say whatever positive to shut you up. It becomes another way to turn a blind eye to suffering and don't want to listen. Am I completely deluded? Okay. And have failed completely to be a good Buddhist and should change my attitude or else go to hell. Ooh, okay. Sorry for the sarcasm. Please hell. Thanks a lot. With metta and gratitude. Okay. So, I think there's always a right time and place for everything. There's not always the right time to think about perhaps the positive of people. Sometimes we just need a little bit of comfort. We need a little bit of time to overcome our hurt or whatever it is with regard to somebody else. So sometimes it is a point. Sometimes if somebody just counters the negative thing with a positive thing, I can see how that can be frustrating. And sometimes you just want to kind of be felt that you are heard or whatever. And then gradually, as you are heard, you're able to deal with that issue, and then eventually you're probably able to even see the positive yourself. You may not even need to be told about the positive qualities. So it really depends on the situation. And I noticed that Ajahn Brahm, for example, if you have something negative to say, usually he just listens and he doesn't really always counteract what you say. So, and that I think is kind of a good way of doing things. So it is all about time and place. And many of these things that we were looking at today in the five ways of overcoming anger and resentment, for example, they work, but they don't always work. Yeah, it's important not to use these things kind of mechanically as if they are, you know, cure all, that are suitable for all kinds of situations. Sometimes things get really, really difficult, and you can't just kind of switch over to seeing the positive in the situation or have compassion or whatever. Sometimes you need to withdraw a little bit. You may need a little bit of counseling, yeah? You may need a little bit just to talk with a friend. You may need to remove yourself from the situation. Sometimes you may even need to see a psychologist, and that's okay. If somebody can help you, that's perfectly fine. So it all depends on the situation. These are kind of the ideal that we try to follow in most situations in life, especially when there are relatively small problems, yeah, and we can deal with it, especially if we are not so advanced on the path, then there is a lot of limits to how we can use these things. So be wise about it. Don't repress things. Don't suppress things in a way which kind of tends to come back with a vengeance later on. If you try to hold the anger down, the negativity down, it's just like trying to hold the lid of a boiling kettle. If you hold the lid of a boiling kettle down, it kind of bang, explodes after a while, and you can't do it. And it's a similar kind of thing with anger. The idea here is to really overcome it, not just to suppress it or to repress it in a way that can lead to psychological damage in the long run. So be wise about these things. When I say, remember, all of the teachings here are general teachings that are, for, you know, generally applicable. It does not mean they are always applicable. When I say to people, be kind to your parents, well, for some people that's incredibly difficult. So what you do is you do your best given your situation, and don't feel guilty if you can't be kind. Yeah, don't be guilty if you feel angry. That just makes the whole situation worse. If you're angry, you're angry. And that is what is the conditioning, that is what is happening to you now, and that's okay. It has to be okay, because that's just what's happening in the present moment. There's no problem with that. Everybody gets angry now and again, almost everyone anyway. So that is fine. And then you try to find the most skillful way of dealing with it, rather than repressing things and making things worse and feeling guilty about stuff. There's no real place for feeling guilty in Buddhism. Yeah, you see you're angry. Oops, I'm getting angry again. Okay, that's to be expected. It's no big deal. Yeah, it's fine to get angry. This person here irritates me always, so often. Okay, that's fine, no problem. Now, what can I do about this? Yeah, what do I need to do in this situation? If you really need to seek counseling or you want to be heard or whatever, of course, there is no issue with that. That's perfectly fine. Time and place is what matters. So, I hope that is helpful. If not, then we can discuss these things later on as well. Okay, dear Ajahn, meditation for children and teenagers, are there any risks or special considerations that should be taken into account? I think that people say, I don't know too much about this, and I think there are some things available out there on the internet, meditation for children and teenagers. They do it in schools, for example. And very often, I understand children often take to meditation very well. They actually enjoy meditation. And sometimes you don't have to call it meditation, you just call it quiet time. Use a word that they understand. Yeah, a small child, you say meditation, they might kind of have no idea what you're talking about. Call it quiet time or something they can understand. And then you have to make it a little bit entertaining for them. Do it in a way in which they don't lose interest. And sometimes you ask them to visualize something, yeah? Visualize something peaceful, like, you know, visualize the blue sky with some clouds going over it or something like that. And then they can do it. Often they are very good at these kind of things. But to be honest with you, I am, you know, when it comes to children, I don't really have much experience. I actually have no experience whatsoever. You know, I'm a monk, for goodness sakes. I have really, really no experience. So try to look online if you are interested in that and see what you can find. There are tools available for these things. I teach one-on-one music lessons, so occasionally end up playing therapist for a troubled teen, but would like to know more before recommending meditation to that age group. Okay. Again, check out what is available online. Metta times infinity, it says. That's pretty good. So metta times infinity. Okay, that's. I guess that means your meditation is going really, really well, I suppose. So that's kind of powerful stuff. So One way of doing for the troubled, you know, for them to get into meditation is, again, getting some guided meditation. Usually in the beginning, most people like to have a bit of guidance because you don't really know what you're doing. So a bit of guided meditation can be useful. Check out what the internet has to say about these things. Do something with, if it's a teen, do something with a bit cool, yeah, and not kind of too stodgy, because then they might kind of turn them off. Things like breath meditation, I think, is very kind of universally acceptable and easy to deal with. So whatever, you know, that teen, I suppose, is inclining towards. You have to kind of know a little bit about the personalities as well. Some people incline towards these things, some people don't. It's really hard to generalize, I think. I know that probably wasn't very useful or very kind of satisfying, but I'm not exactly sure what to say about that. Check out online if there's any advice online about these things. So that's what I recommend it. Dear Ajahn, as I remember, before the Buddha passed away, he told to a person that people from other religions, if they follow the Eightfold Path, that they can get enlightened. How do they gain right view, especially if they believe in a creator God or some other beliefs? That's a good point, yeah? That is kind of the point here. The point here is that, yes, you can call it any religion you like, but in the end, if you're going to be able to practice the Eightfold Path fully, you have to have right view. So in a sense, that already limits things down a little bit, yeah? You cannot really... in other words, there are certain views, there are certain teachings that will stop you from being able to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, and this is part of the problem. So the Buddha is not saying that any person with any kind of view is able to follow the Eightfold Path. That's not really what he's saying. What he's saying is that if you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, then regardless of whatever is the context around that, the context around that is irrelevant as long as you practice this Noble Eightfold Path. If you have certain views that stop you from being practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, then of course there's going to be a natural block there somewhere. But of course, you can go a long way. Yeah, you can go a really long way on that path and still not have right view. You can have samadhi experiences, all of these kind of things. So there's still possibilities there. And of course, once you start to get to samadhi, once you start practicing that deep, then usually your mind tends to open up a little bit. You tend to look at the world in new ways, and you may be more open to Buddhist teachings at that point as well. So there's always new possibilities that arise at that particular point. And then, if you then get right view, then bang, you may still be heading in the right direction. What is an astral projection? Is it true that when we dream, our mind and consciousness goes to the astral realm? I am no expert in astral realms, but as I said before, it is possible to draw your mind out of your body and then send it in all over the place. That's what they say. This is apparently doable. So if you are interested, I think there are books available that actually tell you how to do this kind of thing. Yeah, they give you a step-by-step guide in astral travel. Remember that it is not really, it's not the core of the Eightfold Path. Yeah, it is not kind of the essence of the Eightfold Path, astral travel. In fact, it is very tangential to the Noble Eightfold Path. It may give you some interesting play time. Yeah. It's nice to play around a little bit, but it is not essential. In fact, sometimes it can be directly deluding and drive you off in different direction. So I don't really mind if people do astral travel. If that's what you're interested in, sure, go for it. Find a good book to give you some guidance. Be careful you don't mess things up and it causes you trouble. I don't think there is certainly nothing wrong with that. It may even be interesting from a spiritual view. It may give you some insight into the power of the mind and these kind of things. Dear Ajahn, there's a smile with a kind of saint smile, saintly smile with a kind of, what do you call this? A halo on top of it. Yeah, that's the one, exactly. That's right. Okay. So I'm not sure who that is, but anyway. One, if an animal like the Spanish bull, after being tormented and hurt, gorges the matador to death, Would the animal have created heavy kamma? Please comment. And probably not, because animals are much more driven by instinctual and habitual patterns, and the kamma it would make would probably be very weak. Of course, there is some intention there, because animals also have intentions, but it would be a very weak kind of intention compared to human beings. In human beings, we make much more deliberate choices. Animals, it tends to be much more kind of, you just follow along your nature, and you don't actually make such clear choices in animal life. But I still think it's true that they make a little bit of kamma, yeah, because their intention is there. But there's also the question, what exactly is the intention of that bull? If a matador is kind of, you know, torturing you, probably it's a bit like kind of, I want to get rid of that mosquito. Yeah, that's probably what it's about. This mosquito is kind of tormenting me a little bit, like a very large mosquito. But it's causing so much pain, you just want to get rid of it, just like human beings slap mosquitoes. If you slap a mosquito, it is bad karma, but not terribly bad karma, yeah? It's not the kind of very, very, very evil thing to do. It's worse to kill a bull, for example. Huh? So it would not have created heavy karma, I would say, but a little bit of bad karma, probably. Huh? When can an animal, especially a faithful dog, be reborn as a human? Any chances of going to the Deva realm? Many thanks, and much metta for your wonderful teachings. It is difficult for animals because there is really very little kamma making in the animal realm. The Buddha says so specifically in the suttas. If you get reborn in the animal realm, it's very hard to emerge from that again afterwards because the kamma making basically is not there. So the best way, if you want to help a dog to you know, to be reborn in a good realm, is to be kind to it. Be as kind as you can, because if when animals experience kindness, I think that awakens positivity in them. They become less fearful, they become more trusting. The natural defilements in the dog are probably likely to be subdued if you are kind to the dog. So treat animals well, that's really, I think, what it comes down to. And that then we are maximizing their chances for a good rebirth. But even then, you know, it is the chances, we don't really know what the chances are, but that is how you maximize it. There are some stories in the suttas, or not in the suttas, actually in kind of later literature, about animals being reborn in the heavenly realms. So from those stories, it seems to be possible, but I must admit, I'm a little bit skeptical of some of those stories. I'm not gonna tell them tonight. Okay. Dear Arjan, sometimes when I meditate, there are negative ideas that arise, like sexual and violent ideas. What should I do during this time? Stop or continue? So it depends on the power of these ideas and these thoughts. So how powerful are they? And if they are just minor thoughts that pass through, then often what you can do is just stay with your meditation object. This is kind of the ideal. And very often it doesn't work, but you just stay with the meditation object and it kind of passes through. And then it is done with and you carry on. This is one way of doing this. But often if there is a certain force behind that thought, if it is a thought of ill will, like violence or whatever, then often you need to do something to counteract that. And that was the whole purpose of the two suttas we did today, is the idea how to counteract these negative thoughts, yeah, especially the ill will thoughts. Violence often has to do with other people. So how do you look at that other person in such a way that you can have compassion rather than be violent? That you can be kind rather than having ill will? Yeah, that is what that was all about. So stop yourself in your tracks and say, wait a minute, why am I doing this? How can I re-establish my mindfulness, my way of looking at this person, so actually this violence disappears? Remember, all beings are suffering in this world. We all want to be happy. We're all trying our very best, yeah? And then by thinking like that, you can often overcome that very violence. Sometimes, if it gets very strong, you have to get up and do some walking. Go for a walk in the forest and contemplate these things as you walk, and then change your mind around and think about things in a different way. Yeah, so this is how to overcome this. A very important part of the practice and the path to do that. When it comes to sensual thoughts, it is often more difficult, and the reason why a sensual thought may arise, sometimes it may be connected to the violent thought, because sometimes we find an escape in sensuality if life gets too difficult. So if you get really angry and things get negative and difficult, the only escape we know from difficulties is often sensuality. Yeah. So the mind goes there because things are difficult. And this is one of the reasons why I do not recommend pain meditation. The more pain meditation you do, the more likely the mind will want to escape into sensuality. And you think all kind of thoughts of this kind, because that is where where you have always found your escape in life. This is where beings find escape from the suffering of the world. So this is why we try to find the escape somewhere else. This is why you do your very best to enjoy your meditation practice, yeah? Bring up the happiness and all these kind of things, precisely because then there's less chance of these kind of thoughts arising. And remember also the idea about priorities in life, what really matters, what is important, yeah? Where you're going to find sustained happiness in the future. These are ideas that take a while to mature. Yeah, you have to think about them again and again. It doesn't happen straight away. But if you start now, gradually you will overcome these things, and you will kind of come to an end. So that is some of the ideas. But very often it also takes a while. Yeah, sometimes you come on one retreat and you come back next year, and gradually you learn how to deal with these things in the right way. It is not often doesn't happen. It's often difficult to do these things straight away. Why? Because our habits are so strong. Those habits from the past will kind of carry on when you come on a retreat and when you come to a situation like this. So, the most important thoughts to overcome are the ones with ill will and violence. They are the ones that are the most destructive. So focus mostly on those ones. Dear Ajahn, it is a known fact that the death process is painful. Therefore, hospital staff administer painkillers such as small doses of morphine. This may have an effect on memory. What do you think? I mean, the last thought. Does it indicate in any sutta about painful death? Thank you, in Sadhu Times 3. This is a kind of a common idea in Buddhist circles that you shouldn't take painkillers when you die because your mind gets kind of deluded, you lose your clarity and all of these things. But I don't think there is any real basis for that. And the reason there is no basis for that is because when you, in your dying process, as you're kind of detaching from your physical body, clarity returns, mindfulness returns, yeah, and you see things clearly again. It's only the morphine only works on the physical body. It does not work on the mental body. So as you kind of emerge from your physical body, clarity comes back, and then you're fine. There's no problem there. If you try to do the dying process with lots of pain, and perhaps that can lead to negative consequences as well, because maybe you think, oh, all this pain, I have to endure. This is terrible. It's so painful. So sometimes it can be negative if we try to endure too much pain at a time when we want to be at peace and we want to be relaxed. So I would always encourage people, I would say, use the painkillers. Yeah, don't get too afraid of that. And then mindfulness returns afterwards, and then you move on according to your karma, whatever that is, afterwards. So, that is my take on that. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain what drives us to come out of meditation? That is what decides the end of meditation. Okay, that's a nice kind of question. And usually what you find with your meditation practice is that it tends to have almost like a natural cycle to it. It depends a little bit on how well it goes, but if it goes reasonably well, it has like a natural cycle. Yeah, it kind of builds up and builds up to a certain point, and then it kind of reaches a plateau, and you kind of hang out there for a while, and nothing, it doesn't go any deeper, and then it kind of comes out, and often it comes out quite quickly afterwards. This is often how the meditation goes, yeah? So a good way of doing meditation is to follow the natural cycle of the mind. When you feel you're coming out, okay, then it's kind of finished. Then you can get up and you can do something else. Do some contemplation, go for a walk in the forest, whatever it is. So follow the natural cycles of the mind. Sometimes there may not be much of a cycle because the meditation isn't going so well. Still okay, as long as you feel a little bit better when you come out than when you started, that is still all right. Yeah, and then you come out when it feels kind of okay in those cases. So let it be as natural as possible. That's what I'm saying here. Two, in the jhana state, the mind is completely withdrawn from the five senses. So how does the person come out of this jhana state? It is just like the natural cycle of the other ones. When you enter a jhana, it also has a natural cycle. It builds up, builds up, builds up, until you enter the jhana, you stay on that level. And then when the momentum of that jhana comes to an end, you come out very quickly afterwards. Just like the ordinary meditation, same principle. It's as if you enter it with a certain momentum of peace, and that carries on only so long, and then the mind emerges naturally after a while. In a highly unlikely event that we get into jhana at home, how would you suggest to handle this situation, as family members could likely consider us to be unconscious? Thank you very much. Yes, that would be kind of unfortunate if they send you to the cemetery, yeah, and they kind of you. It's not something I think you need to worry too much about. Usually, it's quite rare that these things happen. One way of doing that is when you do your meditation is to have a please don't disturb sign on the door so nobody comes in to kind of disturb you, or you maybe lock the door where you go, yeah, when you have your little meditation room, you have some rule in your house that when you meditate, you're not to be disturbed. Even if I meditate for 5 hours, yeah, don't disturb me. 5 hours, it means that meditation is going really well. So just let them know that. Or tell your family members that sometimes people get into very deep meditations, yeah? If it looks like I'm dead, feel my body first. If it's not cold, I'm not dead, yeah? Something like that. And then you kind of make it very clear that you're not ready to kind of be sent away to the Karakata yet. Karakata is the local cremation place in Perth. Okay, dear Bhante, kindly explain the difference between clinging and craving. Is there a difference? Thank you so much, Winetta. There is a difference. Yeah, in the dependent origination, you have tanha. From tanha comes upadana. Tanha pachaya upadana. Tanha is the cause, is the condition for upadana. Upadana is translated sometimes as clinging. I think a better translation is taking up. Yeah, you pick something up, and this is both metaphorically and literally picking things up, but mostly metaphorically. We pick things up in our life. We pick up hobbies, we pick up work, we pick up becoming Buddhists, we pick up getting an education, yeah? All of these things are things we pick up. We pick up certain sense pleasures that we enjoy. We pick all of this as a vast number of things that we pick up. So when we crave, yeah, when you crave, what you try to do, you try to find ways to ensure that your craving is satisfied. Yeah? And that is where we do picking up of things. So if you, for example, living in a house, you pick up living in a house. You take that up, living in a house, and you take it up. Why? Basically because it helps you to satisfy the cravings for a nice life. In the house, you feel secure from the elements outside. There's less suffering as a consequence of being there. In your house, you have certain kind of entertainments and happinesses that kind of make your life meaningful and all of these kind of things. Yeah, so a house is a way of securing some degree of happiness for yourself in the sensual realm. The same thing with hobbies you take up, or even becoming a Buddhist. Yeah, why are you a Buddhist? Why do you come here on meditation retreats? It is probably because you want to find some happiness in your life. Yeah, you take these things up. So we crave, then we take up a vast number of things. Work, living in a house, hobbies, having a family, having a religion. All of these things are things we pick up. And then, because of that, our life takes a certain shape. Yeah, all the things that we do give shape to our life, and our life takes a certain direction. And that direction that life takes afterwards, that is the bhava, the existence. We exist in a certain way. So you can see the tanha, pachaya upadana, upadana pachaya bhava. From craving comes taking up, from taking up comes existence. You exist in a certain way. And the most important way of existence is our mental existence. Where is your mind? And this is one of the things that you find out on a retreat like this. Where are the kind of areas that your mind tends to go to on a retreat like this? And that tells you something about your existence. Yeah, what are the things that you fantasize about, think about, things that are important to you? Do you think about your work, your family, about the pleasures of life? Or do you just become peaceful? If you just become peaceful, it means that you really are interested in meditation, and that is your mainstay, yeah? And everything else is kind of irrelevant. Of course, it goes a bit up and down. Sometimes it's a little bit one thing, and other times a little bit something else. And that overall thing, that is your existence, your level of existence, where your attachments are, where your problems are. And that tells you something about where you also will be reborn, because that is a kind of a, where you're hanging out now is where your mind also will tend to go in the future. Okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahmali, words cannot express my gratitude for the way you teach us Dhamma. It seems my eyes have been opened and I have been blind before. My heart was closed and now it is opened. Wow, that's pretty good, isn't it? Well, that's very wonderful. Thank you so much. With love and kindness to you and all the wonderful Sangha at BSW. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's great. What a wonderful little note to get. As we are coming to the end, that's very, very kind of you to say that. So keep on practicing and keep on doing the right thing, and then you will gain even more benefit, hopefully, down the track. Dear Ajahn, can you please explain the meaning of Parimukkang Sati at Anapanasati Sutta? Does it mean that you consider the breath happening right in front of your mind rather than following it as the process happened in the background with metta? I will come to this later on because the Anapanasati Sutta is on one of the suttas I want to talk about. But very briefly, the idea of Parimukka is one of these words that is quite controversial and quite hard to know exactly what it means. Typically, in the commentaries, they say that Parimukka means like on your upper lip or the tip of your nose. And that is why so many meditation systems, they teach just that, because they base that method on the commentaries. It's very, very common in a Theravada tradition that we use the commentaries to kind of to elaborate on the suttas. And often that is okay. But whether Parimukka actually means that or not is actually disputed. Because if you use just what information that is available in the suttas, there is no real reason to think that that is what it means. And the word Parimukka seems to mean something just like in front of you or in the present, yeah? In the present, both physically present, in the here, and also in the now. That's what the sati part comes in. So Parimukkang is like present sati in the present moment, in the here and now, right here. That seems to be the meaning of it. And for that reason, it doesn't really matter so much where you feel the breath. Yeah, it doesn't say anything there about where you feel the breath. And that's why the idea of just knowing the breath is good enough. You know it goes in, you know it goes out. Now, very often, if you start to look at where you actually do know that, it often is a particular place. Initially, you just go in, out, you know, it's going in and out. But if you look very carefully, sometimes you will find that you actually are, it actually happens at a particular place. But I would recommend you not to worry about that. Just do the awareness of the breath, wherever it is. And as your meditation progresses, it will naturally refine down to a certain area, to a particular point, and everything becomes very nice and refined. It will happen all by itself, rather than trying to focus in a particular place, which often can be too tight, too concentrated, too kind of, not really relaxed enough. So this is Ajahn Brahm's method, and he is a super-duper meditator, yeah? So if you follow his method, then I think you're pretty safe grounds as far as breath meditation is concerned. Okay, that is the last question for today. These question sessions are quite long, so there's actually only one more to go now, but you are always welcome to leave during these sessions if you want to. You don't have to stay here because you may feel that you've heard all these questions before or whatever. So please, always, all of these things are voluntary. Yeah, this is the way I think is the best way to run these kind of retreats. Anyway, That's all for tonight. Have a nice rest this evening, and we'll see you again tomorrow morning here.
Sipati panno bhagavato.